Epilogue. Great Art. All great art is hated, Witt said. He shuffled in line, along with a couple hundred other people, one dreary step. It is obscenely difficult, if not impossible, to make something that nobody hates, Witt continued. Conversely, it is incredibly easy, if not expected, to make something that nobody loves. Weeks after the fall of Kolinar, the place still smelled like smoke. Though the city's new masters had moved tens of thousands of humans out to work farms, complete resettlement would take months, if not years. Witt poked the man in front of him in the shoulder. This makes sense, if you think about it. Art is about emotion, examination, and going places people have never gone before to discover and investigate new things. The only way to create something that nobody hates is to ensure that it can't be loved, either. Remove enough spice from soup, and you'll just end up with water. The brutish man in front eyed him, then turned back to the line. Human taste is as varied as human fingerprints, Witt said. Nobody will like everything. Everybody dislikes something. Someone loves that thing you hate. But at least being hated is better than nothing. To risk metaphor, a grand painting is often about contrast. Brightest brights, darkest darks. Not gray mush. That a thing is hated is not proof that it's great art, but the lack of hatred is certainly proof that it is not. They shuffled forward another step. He poked the man in the shoulder again. And so, dear sir, when I say that you are the very embodiment of repulsiveness, I am merely looking to improve my art. You look so ugly, it seems that someone tried, and failed, to get the warts off your face through aggressive application of sandpaper. You are less a human being and more a lump of dung with aspirations. If someone took a stick and beat you repeatedly, it could only serve to improve your features. Your face defies description, but only because it nauseated all the poets. You are what parents use to frighten children into obedience. I'd tell you to put a sack over your head, but think of the poor sack. Theologians use you as proof that God exists, because such hideousness can only be intentional. The man didn't respond. Witt poked him again, and he muttered something in Thalen. You don't speak Alethi, do you? Witt asked. Of course you don't. Figured. Well, repeating all that in Thalen would be monotonous, so Witt cut in front of the man in line. This finally provoked a response. The beefy man grabbed Witt and spun him around, then punched him right in the face. Witt fell backward onto the stone ground. The line continued its shuffling motion, the occupants refusing to look at him. Cautiously, he prodded at his mouth. Yes, it seemed. One of his teeth popped out. Thakfeth, he said in Thalen, speaking with a faint lisp. Thank you, dear man. I'm glad you appreciate my performance art, accomplished by cutting in front of you. Witt flicked the tooth aside and stood up, starting to dust off his clothing. He then stopped himself. After all, he'd worked hard to place that dust. He shoved hands in the pockets of his ragged brown coat, then slouched his way through an alley. He passed groaning humans crying for deliverance, for mercy. He absorbed that, letting it reflect in him. Not a mask he put on. Real sorrow, real pain. Weeping echoed around him as he moved into the section of town nearest the palace. Only the most desperate or the most broken dared remain here, nearest the invaders and their growing seat of power. He rounded to the courtyard out in front of the steps leading up. Was it time for his big performance? Strangely, he found himself reluctant. Once he walked up those steps, he was committing to leave the city. He'd found a much better audience among these poor people than he had among the light eyes of Alethkar. He'd enjoyed his time here. On the other hand, if Raze learned that Witt was in the city, he'd order his forces to level it, and would consider that a cheap price for even the slimmest chance of ending him. Whit lingered, then moved through the courtyard, speaking softly with several of the people he'd come to know over the weeks. He eventually squatted next to Kenny, who still rocked her empty cradle, staring with haunted eyes across the square. "The question becomes," he whispered to her, "how many people need to love a piece of art to make it worthwhile? If you're inevitably going to inspire hate, then how much enjoyment is needed to balance out the risk?" She didn't respond. Her husband, as usual, hovered nearby. "How's my hair?" Whit asked Kenny, or lack thereof. Again, no response. "The missing tooth is a new addition," Whit said, poking at the hole. "I think it will add that special touch." He had a few days with his healing repressed until the tooth grew back. The right concoction had made him lose his hair in patches. "Should I put an eye out?" Kenny looked at him, incredulous. "So you are listening," he patted her on the shoulder. One more, then I go." "Wait here," he told her, then went walking along an alley to the north. He scooped up some rags, the remnants of a Spren costume. He didn't see many of those around anymore. He took a cord from his pocket and twisted it around the rags. Nearby, several buildings had fallen to the Thunderclast's attacks. He felt life from one, and when he drew close, a dirty little face poked out from some rubble. He smiled at the little girl. "Your teeth look funny today," she said to him.
"I take exception to that, as the funny part is not the teeth, but the lack of tooth."
He held out his hand to her, but she ducked back in.
"I can't leave Mama," she whispered.
"I understand," Whit said. He took the rags and cord he'd worked with earlier, forming them into the shape of a little doll.
"The answer to the question has been bothering me for some time."
The little face poked out again, looking at the doll.
"The question?"
"I asked it earlier," Whit said. "You couldn't hear. Do you know the answer?"
"You're weird."
"Right answer, but wrong question."
He walked the little doll along the broken street.
"For me?"
the girl whispered.
"I need to leave the city," he said, "and I can't take her with me. Someone needs to care for her."
A grimy hand reached toward the doll, but Whit pulled it back.
"She's afraid of the darkness. You've got to keep her in the light."
The hand vanished into the shadows.
"I can't leave Mama."
"That's too bad," Whit said.
He raised the doll to his lips, then whispered a choice set of words. When he set it down, it started to walk on its own. A soft gasp sounded inside the shadows. The little doll toddled toward the street, step by step by step. The girl, maybe 4 years old, finally emerged from the shadows and ran to get the doll. Whit stood and dusted off his coat, which was now gray. The girl hugged the patchwork creation, and he picked her up, turning away from the broken building and the bones of a leg sticking from the rubble just inside. He carried the girl back to the square, then quietly pushed the empty cradle away from Kenny and knelt before her.
"I think, in answer to my question, I think it only takes one."
She blinked, then focused on the child in his arms.
"I have to leave the city," Whit said, "and someone needs to take care of her."
He waited until, at long last, Kenny held out her arms. Whit put the child into them, then rose. Kenny's husband took him by the arm, smiling.
"Can you not stay a little longer?"
"I should think you were the first to ever ask me that, Cobb," Whit said. "And in truth, the sentiment frightens me."
He hesitated, then leaned down and touched the doll in the child's hands.
"Forget what I told you before," he whispered. "Instead, take care of her."
He turned and started up the steps toward the palace. He adopted the act as he walked. The twitch of madness, the shuffle to his step. He squinted one eye and hunched over, changed his breathing to come raggedly with occasional sharp intakes. He muttered to himself and exposed his teeth, but not the one that was missing, for that was impossible. He passed into the shadow of the palace, and the sentry hovering in the air nearby, wind rippling her long clothing. Vatwa was her name. Thousands of years ago, he'd shared a dance with her. Like all the others, she'd later been trained to watch for him. But not well enough. As he passed underneath, she gave him the barest of glances. He decided not to take that as an insult, as it was what he wanted. He needed to be soup so bland it was water. What a conundrum. In this case, his art was best when ignored. Perhaps he would need to revise his philosophy. He passed the sentry post and wondered if anyone else thought it irregular that the Fused spent so much time here near this fallen section of the palace. Did anyone wonder why they worked so hard clearing blocks, breaking down walls? It was good to know that his heart could still flutter at a performance. He ducked in close to the work project, and a pair of more mundane singer guards cursed at him to move on toward the gardens with the other beggars. He bowed several times, then tried to sell them some trinkets from his pocket. One shoved him away, and so he acted panicked, scrambling past them and up a ramp into the work project itself. Nearby, some workers broke rocks, and a patch of blood stained the ground. The two singer guards shouted at him to get out. Whit adopted a frightened look and hurried to obey, but tripped himself so he fell against the wall of the palace, a portion that was still standing. "Look," he whispered to the wall, "you don't have many choices right now." Above, the Fused turned to look at him. "I know you'd rather have someone else," Whit said, "but it isn't the time to be picky. I'm certain now that the reason I'm in the city is to find you." The two singer guards approached, one bowing apologetically to the Fused in the air. They still didn't realize that sort of behavior would not impress the ancient singers. "It's either go with me now," Whit said to the wall, "or wait it out and get captured. I honestly don't even know if you've the mind to listen. But if you do, know this. I will give you truths, and I know some juicy ones." The guards reached him. Whit pushed against them, slamming himself against the wall again. Something slipped from one of the cracks in the wall, a moving pattern that dimpled the stone. It crossed to his hand, which he tucked into his rags as the guards seized him under the arms and hauled him out into the gardens, then tossed him among the beggars there. Once they were gone, Whit rolled over and looked at the pattern that now covered his palm. It seemed to be trembling. "Life before death, little one," Whit whispered. The end of Book 3 of The Stormlight Archive.